Welcome to the Sister Source, where women of color can talk about politics, social issues, and learn how to use our collective power for change. My name is Stephanie Magency. I am an advocate, disruptor, and your host. Hello, and welcome to another episode of The Sister Source, a podcast brought to you by the Women's Equity Center and Action Network, or WECAN. On today's show, we will continue our conversation with Reverend Thomas Bowen, this time focusing on the role of the faith community in social justice efforts. Reverend Bowen, thank you for joining me again on The Sister Source.
Oh, thank you, Dr. Magency. It's a pleasure.
In case you missed our last episode, let me tell you a little bit about him. And you'll find his complete bio on the show notes in the WECAN website. The Reverend Thomas Bowen is the Earl L. Harrison Minister of Social Justice at the Shiloh Baptist Church of Washington, D.C., where he has faithfully served as member of its ministerial team since July of 2002. He is also the director of the Mayor's Office of Religious Affairs and the Executive Office of Mayor Muriel Bowser, and is considered the chief advocate and voice of the faith community in the District of Columbia. Reverend Bowen is a proud graduate of Morehouse College, where he was a Ford Foundation Scholar. He also received ministerial and theological training from the Divinity School at the University of Chicago. He was licensed to preach the gospel at his home church, Bethany Baptist Church of Elyria, Ohio, and we're super excited to have him join us again today. If it's okay with you, Reverend Bowen, let's begin with a hard question that calls into question the commitment of the faith community to social justice movement building. Some would say that the faith community's participation in today's civil rights actions feels to be kind of uneven. Some churches are very involved, while a lot of them are mostly silent, seemingly disengaged. Do you think this is a fair assessment of faith, capital F, multiple denominations, congregations, mosques, you know, organizations of all sizes and ideology?
Once again, thank you, Dr. Magency, for having me on the podcast. I wish you continued success in all that you do. It seems whatever you lay your hands on turns into gold. So thank you for your work on behalf of freedom, justice, and equality. You noted that I'm a proud Morehouse grad, but let me assure your listeners, I went to Jesus before I went to Morehouse. Everything's going to be all right.
All right.
As it relates to the role and the present landscape and the faith community, I would just chide us once again to not romanticize history. It was not every Black church being involved in the civil rights movement. In fact, there was some pushback. There was a prominent Black pastor who took issue with Dr. King during the civil rights movement, saying that he shouldn't be talking about politics from the pulpit. He was talking about it too much. This is what led him and others to break away from the National Baptist Convention and to found the Progressive National Baptist Convention with a group of pastors who believe that the Black church ought to be deeply involved in the civil rights movement. You know, we talk about Dr. King and the March on Washington, if our math before the Million Man March is to be believed, there were 200,000 people there. But let people talk about it. Everybody was there at the March on Washington on August 28th, 1963. So at no point in history was every church involved, but we had many. And we had enough We don't need all. We just need enough. We don't want the folk who don't need to be there, whoever they may be. We want the right people. There's a book I think that you introduced, Shiloh, to called Good to Great. That book was about getting people, the right people on the bus, and then getting the right people in the right seat. And that's something that has stuck with me. The faith leaders are there. Whether they go on their own or with their church, I'd rather have them there as individuals than being involved with the need to brand their own their church, because it's not about them. That's not what the agenda should focus upon. It's about right now racial equality and the fight for racial justice. So I do see people of faith involved. And what you see in this moment, you can see it in Washington, D.C. On any given day, there's not just one protest. There could be many. We saw this on Juneteenth, and we saw this over on the 4th of July weekend. There were at least a dozen marches and protests going on, and that's what makes it sound so so well. It's almost like the sound of fireworks in the nation's capital. There were so many going on that you didn't know where it was coming from, but you knew that it was occurring.
One of the things you talk about fireworks, because there are fireworks when you talk about the faith community and social justice in this moment, because of, quite frankly, the so-called evangelical Christians who seem to be so aligned with racist organizations and just racism in general, right? Their support of I don't even want to name some of the groups, but those groups seem to, you know, be giving faith-based organizing, quite frankly, a bad name right now, and Christianity in particular. How do we change that narrative and uncouple white supremacy from evangelical Christianity? Is it possible?
Well, they've hijacked religion, okay, in some cases, and we have to call it out without being sometimes we are afraid to talk about something and to criticize something because we think that it will take away from the larger good. You know, you could not criticize Barack Obama because then you give fodder to his enemies, right? And so we weren't as prophetic as perhaps we should have been at times when it came to certain policies. We know that religion in this country has a bad reputation. It's an ugly story. A friend of mine, Eddie Glaude, has a new book about James Baldwin and his lessons for our age. It's called Begin Again. My friend Eddie, I'm Glaude. And he talks about the need to talk about the messiness of America, our unfulfilled promises, the underbelly, and no clearer could that be seen than in a religious context, that religion started off wrong in terms of its involvement in slavery and naming some ships with some biblical themes. And in fact, it was a later convert or not a later convert, but someone who had a different conversion, who actually manned a slave ship only to then write Amazing Grace in our country. We had folk who went to church on Sunday, but would lynch people on Sunday afternoon and Sunday evening. The whole notion, and they would do it justifying it. We had slaves who stood upon the Bible and held it in the air, like the president standing in front of St. John to Lafayette Square, claiming to have their power and their authority from that which they held in their hand, even if they didn't read and understand it fully. In the country in the 70s and 80s, I never forget what Gardner Taylor, when critiquing the Christian right, who he called neither Christian nor right.
Right.
And we know how the influence for good or for bad, the church is waning, and particularly the influence of white evangelicals. This, to me, is Custer's last stand. But when it comes to being Christian, there are some people who consider themselves to be white Christians who put the emphasis not on being Christian, but on being white. Right. And so we have a problem in that regard. And that's just people utilizing religion. And we see people do it all the time for their own use. Or misuse, if you will, but we can no longer sit back and have the faith, Christianity hijacked by others for their own good, for their own purpose, and for their own aims. That we have to call it out and call them to task. There are some white evangelicals who get it right. Some like a Jim Wallis, who heads and leads some Sojourners, magazine, and he's trying to hold some of his sisters and brothers to task. But the faith has definitely been hijacked.
That hijacking seems to have its roots, like you said, in a twisting of the Holy Writ. What are some of the specific doctrines, and that may not be the right word, or tenets of different faiths that you have used that can be that bridge from, you know, one ideological faith ideology to another, one denomination to another?
Yeah. And I recently discussed with someone the idea of having a billboard or a sign at the back of Shiloh that said Black Lives Matter and quotations, you know, hyphen God, with a note that you know, Shiloh has preached Black Lives Matter since its founding in 1863. When it comes to that whole thought idea, you know, we stand on the entirety from Genesis to Revelation, the fact that God believes that Black Lives Matter from the Christian perspective, for God so loved the world, didn't say white world. It didn't say Western world. It said the world. But then when we get, there's a common strand through many of religious texts that talks about loving your neighbor or doing no harm toward your neighbor. And you know, when and this is a sign that people don't want to love their neighbor when they then ask the question, well, who's your neighbor? Then they want to define it. I like what Anne Lamott has said, that we truly know that we have made a God in our own image when that God loves only the people we love and hates all the people we hate.
Right, right. Powerful. Now, you are one of the founders of the Black Church Project, correct?
Well, I participated. I wasn't one of the founders. I was a participant.
Well, one of the things that the Black church has played a central role, right, in movement building.
Yes.
And, you know, from being a refuge when folks needed a place to stay, passing the plate, you know, being a meeting spot. What kinds of things have you heard more about the Black church doing today as a part of different movements across the country?
You know, and you bring that up, and we talk about the power of the church and its influence. And some people would say that, oh, the church is not that powerful. Well, there was a white racist who walked into a church in Charleston, South Carolina, who thought the church was powerful. And that's why he wanted to silence those inside. There were people throughout our sojourn here in the United States have sought to burn down Black churches because they have seen the power of the Black church. And so, yes, the church has always been there and will continue to be there in some form. And I still see churches opening their doors on a sadder note. Although I'm here on this podcast in my position as Minister of Social Justice at Shiloh Baptist Church, in my good government job, I know that oftentimes when people are looking for resources, that I'm tapped and people ask, is there a church, you know, that can help? One of the saddest stories has to do with individuals who have passed away, who had loved ones pass away in their homes because of COVID. Right. And then needed to clean their home, but did not have the means. And so I've knocked on some doors and asked some church institutions to pay for the cleaning of folks' homes. And not one time has one refused, my asking them to do that. And there's so many things that the church does, financially, how it opens up its doors in other ways that don't make the paper or not talked about on a podcast, except for this one, and it happens day in and day out. There's so many stories that I don't hear them all. But the church continues, to make a way as we are, talking now. There are, clergy in Ward 7, walking the street, drawing attention, to gun violence, in neighborhoods. So I do hear about, and I do see, churches and once again, if there's someone listening under the sound of my voice who looking for a good church, give me a call and I can give you a list of those that I can sign off on. My name is Thomas Bowen, and I endorse this message.
I love it, and I'm sure you will. And you can find his contact information in the show notes at Women's Equity on Twitter and at womensequity.org online. Thank you for that shameless plug. Shiloh Baptist Church has a social justice ministry, mm-hmm. and you are the minister of social justice.
Yes. There.
Not many faith-based institutions have such a ministry. Can you tell the Sister Source audience, especially those who attend a faith institution struggling to get their house of worship more engaged in social justice efforts, some tips and tricks, what would you say to them about how to get something like that started?
Well, Dr. McGinnsey, now I've been at Shiloh since July of 2002, 18 uh-huh. years this month. Now, don't laugh at me. I'm aging both myself and you. I've known you since day one.
That long, right?
Yeah, I came there as a youth minister. Thought I'd spend 2 years there because I was still working Mayra Edelman at the Children Defense Fund. Mm-hmm. But at the end of what I thought to be my 2 year sentence, and I was eligible for parole, I began to work full time. Mm-hmm. And then added some other duties as assigned and some other titles, until finally, I found myself, as minister of youth, as minister of outreach, and as minister of social justice. And now, mm-hmm. Because responsibilities outside the church is just the Earl L. Harrison minister of social justice. I think that every church, not just every black church, but every church, in our country and in the world needs a social justice ministry. And I learned this from Dean, Harold Trulier, Dr. Harold Trulier at Howard Divinity School. Too many times in churches, we think that certain work is the work of a few people, that reentry ministry is just for those people, but it's actually the ministry of the church. And so it is my responsibility, I think, to bring issues, to the fore of the entire congregation. Because if it's just a group of folk meeting in a gym once a month, about a dozen in number, that's not good enough. We have to inform and engage the church on the issues of the day. My friend, once again, Eddie Gloss, says that he thinks that churches should deal with have only one issue. I wish we had that luxury. There's so many issues going on. Mm-hmm. that we can't help but be involved in voter suppression and in gun violence in issues of human sex trafficking and education and equity. Mm-hmm. But I think that it's we have to bring it to the fore of the congregation. We have to supply our passage so it makes its way into the sermons. Because you should be reading the Bible in one hand and newspaper in the other, and it helps really with the preaching moment when you have a learned congregation that can go with you as you equate. And I think that everything in the Bible relates to a social justice issue. Well, that's the lens that I carry with me to reading the mm-hmm. Bible. And if you look for something, you're going to find it. Jesus being nailed to a cross was an injustice mm-hmm. that worked out for our good. and it was a fulfillment of a prophecy, but it was still an injustice that brought Jesus to the cross in the first place. And I think that was intentional to let us know how we can always try to bring something good out of a bad situation. And that's George Floyd's death, right? That look of all of that. And if Time magazine doesn't name him as the person of the year this year, I'm going to stop reading Time magazine, because he has had an impact on our life. Not just for this year, but for years to come. So we ought to have social justice ministry, I think, at all of our churches, that we can find at least one, although I think you'll find many issues that you can get your congregation to commit to.
So if the Women's Equity Center and Action Network were to create a toolkit of resources and, you know, not necessarily a roadmap, because everyone is going to be on every faith-based institution is going to be on their own journey. Uh-huh. Do you think that would be helpful?
Let me tell you, I hesitate to say this, but we got a lot of lazy folks in churches. Uh-huh. So we need to supply them with information. If you put together some resources and assign the proper text to them, you've done the work. For many folks, that's one of the gifts I used to like from the Children Defense Fund, that it handed people talking points. It wrote mm-hmm. the op-eds for folk. All they had to do was just sign on it. So, you know, you're writing a piece as it relates to your issue, and then giving some minister with little time on his hands the ability to use what you've written for him, as some Baptist ministers do without giving credit. Then they would love that aspect, and you would have done them a service to supply the information. So we need groups like the Women's Equity Center to supply our congregations, our church, with talking points and things to preach about and things to activate their churches around.
Absolutely. Thank you for that encouragement. And, you know, I've heard someone say one time that, you know, the first time they'll say, "We can," said it. The second time it'll be "someone said," and then the third time it'll be "I said."
Right. Yeah, you said it one time.
That's right. I'm totally okay with that too.
Or as I like to do on time. First of all, I like to give people credit, because that means I'm well read and learned. But oftentimes, to make yourself feel even more learned is, who was it that said? Because I read so much that I can't recall who it was. Who was it that said?
Yes, you do. And I have a question for you about what you're reading what's on your night table in a second. Mm-hmm. Now, we talked about on the last episode the divides and some of the challenges, criminal justice, of course, the pandemic raging. And one of the big challenge is that faith-based organizations, we're not able to convene right now, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Most faith leaders are following public health orders and are not convening in person. How do you think the inability to gather in person is affecting ministry here in D.C. and nationwide?
I think it's impacting people differently. I've had conversations with more than one pastor who says that they're doing better by not coming to meet in person than they were when they had to meet in person. And in fact, people were actually giving more. But they had already done the hard necessary work of saving up for a rainy day or actualizing what they preached in terms of having enough in the storehouse in their time of need. But this is called for a necessary update on the way we communicate. And going forward, we're always going to have to treat evenly those who are in the sanctuary and those who are listening to us via live stream or a Facebook, which then gives us the opportunity to take the message broadly and mm-hmm. give individuals also the opportunity to view and participate in service in their leisure. The important thing is that they're participating and mm-hmm. that they're reading, and they can run a few minutes late to Facebook and the like. Do you actually lose something by being dressed up in your living room watching a Facebook as opposed to listening right. to it on your speakers in the shower? You're still mm-hmm. listening to what's being said, and if it's, and what's being said resonates. It resonates no matter the posture of the person who's listening to it. So I think that the challenge will make us stronger in terms of communication, and as we spoke about in our, in a previous podcast, this is called for more intergenerational work mm-hmm. in the church. I was seeing someone I had to preach remotely, and they had a young person who was guiding me, and I joked with the pastor. They didn't take it very kindly. I said, are they paying you to come? I said, I know some churches hard up. They're paying young people to come to their church. Make sure they pay you to come. But they're having to relinquish some things and rely on what young people are showing them. But you know, you before this, you had folk already evolved. My friend Otis Moss and Trinity United Church of Christ in Chicago, they had at least for a decade had what they called digipastors. And the digipastors are the ones who help with the broadcast and the YouTube and everything else. So I think that there's a unique role that young people will play in the life and ministry of the church going forward.
Well, you know, the church is the church in my experience. Okay, mm-hmm. is a training and proving ground for young people, right? That's where a lot of us learned how to speak in front of a crowd,
yes,
right?
Yes.
In the safe and welcoming environment of the church. Mm-hmm. That's where a lot of us learned how to do research, you know, on a topic that we could share either in Sunday school or, you know, in some other context. Mm-hmm. The church, for me, has also been a place of intergenerationality. Mm-hmm. That's why I learned to sit at the feet of the wise old yes. mothers of the yes. church mm-hmm. and, you know, take in all that they were telling me about everything from, you know, how to make tea cakes to how to be a good wife, mm-hmm. you know, just a wealth of information. How do we tap into that? You know, mm-hmm. both the training and proving ground that the church can be, and the intergenerational aspect of it, as we're trying to grow social movement and social justice work in faith-based organizations.
Yeah, one thing that I didn't highlight before in the question was that if we cannot judge, we cannot mold a ministry around what happens inside those walls. That the church is not what happens inside those walls. It's what happens outside the walls. The story is told of someone who went to a church service late and didn't realize that the service started at a certain time. And mm-hmm. they wanted to come back, but they didn't want to miss the start time. So they asked an usher, well, what time does church service begin? And the usher said, church service begins after the benediction. Right. It's not just that which takes place within the sanctuary. It's that which takes place out of the outside of the sanctuary, where that's where the real work of the church is done, out there in the community and out there in the streets. I'm grateful that many of congregations have continued to serve the function in the community during the pandemic, because those in need them now more than ever. And you're right. There are many of us who've gotten their start in mm-hmm. the church. Although we went kicking and screaming and crying. it wasn't until I got to high school that I realized that every black person didn't go to church on Sunday morning. I was surprised that there were people who didn't go to church, wondering what did you do with your time on Sunday. But a lot of us having to say our pieces at mm-hmm. Christmas and Easter and learn on those, unless the only thing we had under the tree were lights. Mm-hmm. And that the church was the original American Idol, right? Mm-hmm. that you would learn whether you could sing or not, dance and everything else by right. the people sitting in those pews there. You know, one of the favorite things, and your son Chris participated in this at Shiloh, you know, for a long time, for Youth Sunday, we'd have the young people, select group, maybe, you know, six or seven, mm-hmm. to give the sermonettes. on Youth Sunday, and what a great thing that was to get up in front of a congregation. And we had an encouraging crowd. There are people right. who wanted to know, how were you doing in school? When you came home from college, there are people who put some folding money in your
right,
hand,
right.
along with their prayers. One of the grand moments for a young person and a family growing up in the church was that Sunday when you had to read that announcement of the graduation or said that name. And you have folk who come that Sunday who never went to church, even on Mother's Day, Christmas, and Easter, but they were there to hear right. the name of their loved one, you know, the graduation of so-and-so from Howard University or from Princeton. That was a high moment, and the church wrapped their arms around on those individuals.
Yeah, it's definitely, being involved in the church definitely laid very important groundwork for me personally, a strong foundation. Mm-hmm. Now, how do we build on the current momentum over the summer leading up to the November elections? Because, you know, in my humble opinion, we are likely going to be still deep in the middle of the pandemic. Folks might even be more fearful at that point once the flu season hits to go out to the polls. There are a number of national initiatives like Souls mm-hmm. to the Polls, you know, where mm-hmm. churches are using their vans to take people out, you know, to their polling places. What other kinds of things could we do, or direction should we can be giving to faith-based organizations to steady them and ready them for November 3rd?
Well, I always believe that the aim of one of the aims of the church is to have members who are 100% tithing and 100% voting. That if those can become two goals, we can create some power because we'll have more money to do outreach programs in the community. Mm-hmm. But when people think that the entirety of this church votes, then they're going to deal with you just a little bit differently. And that's something that heretofore was the thought that the people in the church, they vote. So you got to make your way to them. I hope and wish that every Sunday after Labor Day we'll be dealing with voting in some aspect, getting people ready, providing them with information. And you know, Black preachers have always walked that line between the separation mm-hmm. of church and state. Mm-hmm. Many preachers who understood that they could not endorse candidates from the pulpit, particularly you may have had two people running at the same time from the same church.
Mm-hmm.
But somebody in their wisdom and their grand eloquence would say, I cannot endorse Barack Obama from the pulpit, but if I could, I sure would endorse Barack Obama. But since I can't, I dare
right.
not endorse Barack Obama. So we're going to have to find ways to make sure that we beat that drum, mm-hmm. and then we get the message out there. And we ought not have to give reasons for folk to vote or who to vote for. But let's play that game. Because the game has consequences, and we cannot afford to lose. It's almost like George Will said some years ago. I think it was after when the second Bush's time was coming up, and mm-hmm. it's funny how he doesn't seem so bad right now. But George Will wrote a column in the Post. He said, "If the Democrats lose this election, then they're in the wrong business."
Mm-hmm.
And then the Dems can't win this election, and the Dems are in the wrong business. So we got to have a discussion. Our discussion is about a Black woman as vice president. Our discussion is about a Black woman as attorney general, and our discussion is about a Black woman on the Supreme Court. And it's funny how one person could fit all of that in Kamala Harris, but Van Dellums. But we need to look at policy. And position, as well as power and influence. And we have a chance to influence all of that and have a grand celebration. So we have to become more astute, and that's why we need to utilize pulpits as public places of disseminating information to the people who most need it, so that we'll indeed be ready. We gotta thwart the attempts of many a people to try to taint the idea of absentee balloting. I think right. that the, we should have all our ballots turned in as much as possible before we even get to a November. That the first day that we're eligible, we should have those and utilize our time organizing the community to have voted, and then spend our time the weekend and the day of election trying to get other people to go out and vote, handing them out sandwiches and water and back massages as they stand in line to go to vote.
Right, because it's gonna be a challenge. We're gonna have to. Democracy is a messy business, and we're going to have to put the work in.
And there was a sister, a singing star, who did that, that when people were standing in line in Louisville, Kentucky, she sent pizza. She didn't even live in the state. She sent pizza for the people mm-hmm. who were standing in line so they would have something to eat, encourage them to continue to stand in line and vote.
That is, I'm going to steal that idea, and you'll see that as a weekend campaign come November. We'll be trying to activate our network in that way. Stay tuned, sisters. I'll have instructions. So we're near the end of our time. I have two questions. Mm-hmm. One is, and I alluded to this earlier, we've covered a lot of ground, mm-hmm. But let's take a quick detour. You mentioned one book by your good friend, Eddie Glaude, that we all need to read. I know you're an avid reader. What are some titles you recommend to the Sister Source audience?
It was one of the campaign staffers and advisors to Barack Obama who talked about how things had changed and that their sights were no longer on what would be on the front page of a newspaper, but what would next day what would be in your inbox first thing mm-hmm. in the morning. So it's not just what I'm reading, it's what I'm listening to.
Okay.
I'm grateful for podcasts, and I'm grateful for audiobooks, and what's in my listening list is The End of Policing by mm-hmm. Alex Vitale. Great book. White Fragility. Mm-hmm. I loved No You Shut Up by Simone Sanders. I Can't Wait to Get to the System by Robert Reich, which I downloaded on yesterday, that talks about how we can fix a broken system in the United States. So yeah, it's Eddie Glaude's book, Begin Again, which I'm actually reading since he sent me the copy.
Right.
And then The End of Policing, because it's so much of our discussion. And then as a birthday gift to myself, I'm going to listen to all 36 hours of Frederick Douglass by David Blight.
Wow, I didn't know that. I'll have to check that out. Mm-hmm. Since we have even more time now.
And Color Law by Richard Rothstein is pretty great too.
Excellent. We'll put links and a description to all of these titles in the show notes for those of you that are listening. Let's close on a high note. Mm-hmm. We began the last episode with you sharing a few things that are keeping you up at night. Let's end this episode and our time together, at least this time together. I hope to have you on many times in the future. But let's end with one thing that gives you hope.
Mm-hmm. Black Lives Matter gives me hope.
Okay.
It gives me hope. You know, when you see people taking to the streets all over. We see how multicultural it is and how it cuts across lines and generation. And when you see people invoking the need of trans women of color, all these things give me hope that our future is in great hands. Because our future is concerned about their own future. And so some of the voices that I listen to, who thought that certain monuments would come down? Who thought mm-hmm. that the Washington Football Club would change its name? Who thought that a lot of what we're seeing right now is actually occurring, realizing that the window and the door may close quickly, but this is an opportunity like none before, and seeing the young people, and not when I say I'm talking about the young, even some, you know, what some would call babies. I think that their willingness to put themselves on the line gives me hope.
Well, there you have it, sisters. Thank you so much, Reverend Thomas Bowen, Earl L. Harrison, Minister of Social Justice, at the Shiloh Baptist Church of Washington, D.C. Thank you, thank you, thank you for joining us today. And stay tuned. Next time, we'll be talking about self-care. So for those of you sisters who are already leading at the front lines of a movement, and those of you who are gearing up to take on expanded roles, we're going to talk about how you can be prepared to take care of yourself as you are working hard in your community. Thank you very much for listening.